You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Marie Nye, president of the Open Society Institute, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here for a discussion of Judith Armata's new book, Twilight of Impunity, The War Crimes Trial of Slobodan Milosevic. We're going to hear from Ms. Armata, who will talk about the book and her work on it. Judith Armata had the pleasure, of being in the courtroom throughout the Milosevic trial and survived the experience. Before that, Judith Armata had worked in the former Yugoslavia, had established an office there for the Central and East European Law Initiative of the American Bar Association, and had also conducted investigations of war crimes that were committed during the Kosovan war. We also have Nina Bang Jensen, who was the executive director of the Coalition for International Justice, which sponsored the work of Judith Armata in the Hague, monitoring the Milosevic trial. The Coalition for International Justice was an outgrowth of the Central and East European Law Initiative of the American Bar Association. And it was established at a time when it appeared that the governments that had joined to establish the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia might back away from the tribunal or undercut or even terminate the work of the tribunal, and it was established to support the tribunal, but also to make sure that it operated effectively on behalf of the interests of justice, but also on behalf of fair trials for the defendants, and it extended its work also to deal with other international criminal tribunals. I think that in the period that the coalition was operating, I thought that Nina was certainly the person in the United States who knew most about the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. So Judith will speak first, and then I will call on Nina, and then if I'm inspired, I may add a few comments myself or ask a couple of questions, and then open it up to general discussion. So with that, let me call on Judith.
Thank you, Arye. And thanks, everybody, for coming. I really appreciate your coming out to listen to what we have to say about actually a pretty important subject. I'd like to thank the Open Society Institute for sponsoring this, and also for Kelly Askin for getting everything together and organizing it and putting me up at night, overnight, above and beyond. I think that what I want to do is to read a little bit from the book. And mostly the interesting part for me is to hear when you all have questions, and so we can just talk about what is really of importance to you. And what I've chosen to read is really the introduction, because it gives kind of an overview of the trial. That One part that leaves out that's very important to me is the voice of the victims who testified, and because that's throughout the book, and that's a very important part of the book. One of a number of reasons that I wrote the book, obviously everybody couldn't tell their stories, but I felt it was important for those who came from the former Yugoslavia and risked what they did to come and testify. It meant a lot to them. It was very difficult. Many of them felt that they were representing people who had died. So I honor them, and I think that one of the hard parts for me about the trial was that it was held so far away from the former Yugoslavia in The Hague for very valid reasons. The war, war was still going on when it was started. But it made it very difficult for any people from the Balkans to attend the trial. And I think it contributed also to the media and other people not being as aware of the reason for the trial. There are a variety of reasons for the trial, but certainly the main one is that people were victimized and suffered horrible losses of life and losses of their ways of life. And had they been more present, I think that people would have paid more attention to that, as well as to Milosevic and the fact that, what was happening with him and what he was doing. So, but I will just read from the introduction, and then we'll pass it on to Nina. Carlo Del Ponte opened the trial by saying, well, actually, this wasn't from the opening of the trial, but this is a quote by her. "This prosecution is arguably the most significant trial ever to be held of a political leader and head of state. By the indictment he faces, the accused is alleged to be the principal cause of much of the crime, tragedy, and misery occasioned by the three wars covered by the charges. The trial of Slobodan Milosevic for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide was proclaimed to be history-making. At the time, only one other sitting head of state had been called to account in an international court for war crimes, Admiral Karl Dönitz, who became Germany's head of state for a brief period after Adolf Hitler's suicide. Given his limited rule, the part he played in the Nuremberg trial of top Nazis was a historical footnote. The trial of Milosevic, by contrast, was the calling to account of a man who had been at the apex of power for a decade. The historical nature of the case ensured that it would be used as a measure to guide future trials of political leaders for its failings as well as its achievements. It would also be used in debates over whether there should be trials at all, given its length, cost, problematic nature, and abrupt, inconclusive end. The trial was about one person. It did not and could not provide a complete historical record or a full accounting of all people who perpetrated war crimes. A criminal trial judges an individual defendant's responsibility for crimes. It does not apportion guilt among individuals or ethnic groups. In the end, a trial is a judicial assessment of evidence presented by the prosecution and the accused. In a criminal trial, proof of guilt for crimes charged must be beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest standard of proof in law. The prosecutor alone bears the burden. The accused is not obligated to present any evidence to refute it. In the wake of the Second World War, the Allies convened an international military tribunal to try top Nazis for war crimes rather than summarily execute them, though initially Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill favored the latter. The main trial of 22 top leaders, popularly known as the Nuremberg trial, lasted 10 months and ended in the acquittal of 3 and death sentences for 12. Other trials were held in Germany and another military court tried top Japanese officials in Tokyo. The major powers had taken a step toward the rule of law in world affairs. It was not the first step, but it was a significant one. Progress toward international enforcement of a universal norm of behavior faltered for 50 years during the Cold War. Yet those who believed in justice and an international order based on the rule of law continued their efforts. The end of the Cold War created space for the enforcement of human rights principles at the international level. Near the same time, in 1991, war came once again to Europe as Yugoslavia erupted in flames. Images of emaciated men behind barbed wire, women and children fleeing burning homes, and cities and villages besieged by armies were broadcast by television into homes around the world, provoking public outrage. The United Nations imposed an arms embargo that unintentionally favored Serb forces, inheritors of the Yugoslav People's Army arsenal. Europe, and later the United States, sent diplomats to negotiate an end to the conflict. The goal was peace, not a just peace. Diplomatic efforts produced little until 1995. Under pressure to do something, with states unwilling to sanction military intervention, the United Nations in 1993 established a court to try those responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Most did not expect it to work, only to relieve the pressure to act. Others hoped that the existence of a tribunal would deter more atrocities. While the tribunal failed to satisfy either expectation, it came to serve an important purpose. As it tried those accused of crimes related to the conflict, the tribunal institutionalized the principle of accountability for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. International conventions and treaties defining acts so criminal that they were intolerable even in war became more than aspirational declarations of intent. With the advent of the ICTY, and soon after the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, these documents came to life. Establishment of these courts lent impetus to the founding of a permanent international criminal court. From now on, people concluded, crimes offending our deepest sense of humanity would be punished. Impunity had been dealt a blow. Initially, only small fry were turned over to the ICTY, but that changed over the years through the tireless efforts of activists and as the tribunal's usefulness began to be recognized by real politicians. Nevertheless, among diplomats and heads of state, there remained the sense that certain influential people, like President Slobodan Milosevic of Serbia and President Franjo Tudjman of Croatia, were most useful as negotiators on the diplomatic stage than behind bars. By working with these men, the diplomats hoped to negotiate an end to the conflict. Prosecutors continued their investigations, however, which led inexorably to the palace doors. When Milosevic mounted his fourth and last war in Kosovo, the evidence came together, helped by the United States at long last providing real intelligence beginning in 1998. On 24 May 1999, Louise Arbour, chief ICTY prosecutor at the time, issued an unprecedented indictment against him and four of his top military and political associates for war crimes and crimes against humanity in relation to the armed conflict in Kosovo, which still raged. It was followed by indictments for war crimes against humanity and genocide during the wars in Croatia on 8 October 2001 and Bosnia-Herzegovina on 22 November 2001. With whom would the diplomats now negotiate? An indicted war criminal? In fact, they did, and soon there were rumors of a deal with Milosevic under which he would not be arrested and handed over to the ICTY if he helped broker an end to hostilities. Milosevic was a sitting head of state when he was indicted for crimes associated with the war in Kosovo. At the time, he seemed safe from arrest. His alleged co-conspirators, Radovan Karadzic, former president of the Republika Srpska, and Ratko Mladic, head of its army, had been indicted 4 years earlier but remained at large. It looked unlikely that Milosevic would face charges anytime soon. His fortunes changed on 5 October 2000, when a popular movement ousted him from power for again stealing elections in Serbia. Despite the vote count, Milosevic refused to accept the outcome that he had lost the Serbian presidency to Vojislav Koštunica, claiming that it had been fraudulently secured. People took to the streets while the army and police stood by, refusing to intervene on his behalf. Soon after, Serb authorities arrested him for abuse of office, including financial misdealings, diversion of public funds, damaging Serbia's economy, and introducing hyperinflation. Under pressure of a cutoff in aid from the United States, Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic of Serbia orchestrated the former president's arrest and removal to The Hague on 28 June 2001, the Serbian High Holy Day marking its revered Battle of Kosovo Polje in 1389. No doubt Milosevic considered that the greatest insult. On 29 June 2001, Slobodan Milosevic arrived at the prison in Scheveningen, where accused ICTY war criminals are held pending the outcome of their cases. In less than a year, on 12 February 2002, his trial began. As in any criminal case, the prosecution had the burden of presenting evidence to support its charges with proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The task was formidable. It encompassed three wars fought in as many locations over a decade, conflicts which were alleged to be part of a joint criminal enterprise, involving dozens of named and unnamed perpetrators. The challenge was to make the case expeditious, comprehensive, and comprehensible, goals that often proved contradictory. Deciding which crimes to charge out of so many possible ones was not easy. Given sufficient evidence, the prosecution had to weigh a number of sometimes competing considerations. The numerous victims from hundreds of crime sites wanted their suffering acknowledged. The public had an interest in knowing the truth about Milosevic's involvement in the wars, but required that it be delivered promptly and understandably. The court needed as full a reckoning as possible, but no more than that, to reach a fair decision in a way that would enable it to track, recall, and evaluate the evidence. Similarly, the trial had to be understandable to the accused if he was to answer the grievous charges against him, charges that, if proved, would put him behind bars for the rest of his life. The trial of a head of state for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide is distinctly different from a domestic murder trial, as well as from a war crimes trial of a direct perpetrator. History and context become important in ways they are not in other criminal trials. To establish that Milosevic was responsible for ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, for example, the prosecution had to show that there was a plan to create an enlarged Serbian state dominated by Serbs, through the commission of egregious crimes, and that Milosevic supported the plan in concrete ways. Short of a signed order to drive people from their homes, evidence of what social and historical conditions produced the plan and why Milosevic originated or joined it was important to prove his responsibility. Determining the breadth of the criminal plan and the crimes needed to execute it required substantial evidence. The final indictment encompassed three conflicts, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo, carried out over nearly a decade throughout extensive areas of the former Yugoslavia. Milosevic was charged with criminal liability for his participation in what the prosecution called a joint criminal enterprise to force non-Serbs out of large sections of territory that would then become predominantly Serb and would eventually be attached to Serbia proper, thus diluting opposition to Milosevic's rule. He was also charged with responsibility based on his de jure legal and de facto actual position of command over forces alleged to have committed crimes. Finally, he was charged with responsibility as a principal actor or accomplice in the name of genocide against the Bosnian Muslims. In one of its most criticized decisions, the prosecution opted to combine the three indictments into one mega trial. The advantage of doing so was practical in that it saved certain witnesses from having to repeat their testimony. It also made for a more coherent telling of how the conflicts evolved under Milosevic's guiding hand. In one sense, they were all of a piece, designed to preserve and enhance Milosevic's stature and power. Because the prosecution received approval to join the cases as trial was about to begin, it lacked time to effectively fold the indictments into one, resulting in multiple charges for the same criminal act. The indictment could have been streamlined by reducing the factual allegations and would still have presented an overall picture of the criminal scheme, as I will discuss later chapters. Critics argue that separating the cases would have enabled completion of at least one of them within a reasonable time, thus preserving the public's interest in securing a judgment before Milosevic's death ended the proceedings altogether. Yet justice takes time. While justice should be expeditious for all concerned, summary justice, as in executions and show trials, is no justice at all. That the trial would last more than 4 years was neither foreseen by the prosecution nor the fault of its case organization. Milosevic, his illness, and his insistence on representing himself caused the excessively long trial. The court, too, bears responsibility for failing to stop his clear manipulation of the rules. Viewed by some as more spectacle than judicial proceeding, the trial lasted 466 days over the 4 years before ending abruptly with Milosevic's death. Before it even began, Milosevic denounced the tribunal as a fraud and refused to acknowledge its validity to try him. Claiming the role of persecuted hero, he rejected representation by legal counsel, declaring instead his intention to represent himself. Yet he had no intention of defending himself, as he clearly announced to the court, only to accuse his accusers. Since he was ousted from power and locked up, he would take full advantage of his one opportunity to make his case to the public and to history. The court failed to recognize the inherent contradiction of Milosevic's assuming a role in a proceeding that he considered illegitimate and granted his request for self-representation, thus giving him a soapbox for his political agenda. While long-term Balkan followers were not fooled by his mischaracterizations of history, much of the highly propagandized Serb public fell under his spell, thereby deferring to a distant future the possibility of coming to terms with the bloodshed and destruction wrought in their name. From his defendant's chair in a Hague courtroom, Milosevic depicted himself as a hero, victim, and martyr, or not just for his people, but for all those oppressed by Washington's pursuit of dominance and Western corporate greed. That in itself is an injustice. While good reasons exist to criticize the exploitation of smaller nations by the United States throughout its history, Milosevic, who oppressed so many of his own citizens, was a false champion of the world's oppressed. The court's decision to permit Milosevic to represent himself was likely made to encourage him to participate in the trial rather than sit silently throughout, a stance which would have made the proceedings resemble a show trial. From that perspective, any participation short of disruption was welcome. For his part, Milosevic was willing to play by the rules to a certain extent to maintain access to a forum. While the court's decision to allow Milosevic to represent himself was understandable, that decision and the court's need to provide more latitude to a self-represented accused contributed substantially to the appearance that Milosevic was controlling the trial. This seriously limited the trial's effectiveness, at least with regard to the goal of furthering truth and reconciliation in the region, a long-term project in any case. By seeking to avoid the appearance of a show trial, the court contributed to the appearance of the trial as a show, directed by Milosevic. This does not lead to the conclusion that Milosevic should not have been tried or that the trial was a farce. Far from it. Despite its often high drama and the spectacle that Milosevic sought to create, the trial was above all a legitimate legal proceeding in a legally established court by which a former head of state was brought to answer for his role in crimes and atrocities that shocked the world's conscience. The Milosevic trial has been criticized as an example of what not to do, and been too easily dismissed as a result. Legitimate criticisms of the trial do not lessen its importance. Often more is learned from mistakes than successes. When another accused, Vojislav Šešel, insisted on representing himself at the ICTY, Judge Wolfgang Schomburg allowed it, but immediately appointed standby counsel who could take over should the accused become disruptive, something for which he is known. Influence of the Milosevic trial was also evident in the trial of Saddam Hussein, where prosecutors chose to try a number of distinct cases rather than combine the atrocities of Hussein's long rule into one super case. This may not have been a wise decision, particularly since Hussein was executed after the first trial, eliminating the possibility of making him answer for his many other crimes. There is no doubt the Milosevic trial will be studied by future courts, prosecutors, and defendants, for its successes as well as its failures. It would have been surprising if this first among trials had proceeded smoothly. That it did not does not justify foregoing such trials in the future. The alternatives to trying a head of state for widespread atrocities are unpalatable at best, summary execution and impunity. Both undermine respect for the rule of law, and the latter necessarily condones crimes against humanity and ensures their repetition. While Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, whether on the South African model or another, have a useful role to play in societies grappling with the results of years of civil conflict, they cannot replace the need for justice. This is perhaps most true when dealing with the ultimate leaders and strategists behind war crimes and crimes against humanity. It is far easier to contemplate reconciliation between a young soldier who shows genuine remorse for his crimes committed under orders and the family of his victim than between that family and the man who devised the strategy requiring the murder of innocents to serve his thirst for power. International criminal law is in its infancy. While it has supporters, it also faces great obstacles. not least of which are the powerful states who refuse to submit to its governance while continuing to undermine it in their singular pursuit of self-interest. Under the best circumstances, justice is not perfect, more so when it lacks long traditions and well-established institutions to support it. For all their mistakes, failures, and inadequacies, the new institutions of international criminal law require and deserve support. They are the institutions of an aspirational world, one based on justice for everyone, regardless of power, position, or privilege. The alternative is a world where those who wreak great havoc on their fellow humans are rewarded with golden parachutes, like the exile of the former Ugandan president, Idi Amin, living out his days in a palace in Saudi Arabia after murdering 300,000 of his own citizens, looting the state treasury, and leaving an economically and psychologically devastated country. While such diplomatic solutions may end fighting for a time, they do not bring justice. They leave the future open to continuing cycles of revenge and bloodshed, festering hatreds ripe for exploitation by the next dictator seeking to grasp or hold on to power. Victims, along with their pain and loss, receive no golden parachutes. They are left with their countries, livelihoods, and lives devastated. Worse, they are left with the belief that the rest of the world does not care. International justice has been opposed by those who cry that it violates state sovereignty. Precisely. International justice comes into play where a sovereign so abuses his power over his citizens as to offend our sense of what it means to be human. International justice declares that no sovereign should have that right. By his criminal acts, the sovereign forfeits his power. International justice tells the victims that when they are brutalized, others will not stand silently by. International justice should be the avenging angel outside the cell door, who stands as a warning to all abusers of power. Only we, individuals joined together, not some superhuman entity, can make international justice a reality. Thank you. Next.
Nina.
Thank you, Aria, and thank you, Judith. Aria has been characteristically modest, of course. I mean, the Coalition of International Justice would not have existed. It was his idea, and our accomplishments are really a credit to him and to OSI. I will not be modest about my decision to hire Judith Armada. It was one of the best decisions I made. She arrived on the weekend before she was going to The Hague. We had always had someone in the little broom closet in the lobby of the ICTY since day one doing advocacy work and keeping us informed, but we had actually never had anyone who we were going to assign to be fully in the courtroom every day writing. I was very pleased. Judith had come well recommended. She lived in Montenegro, Serbia, knew the culture, knew the war, and that was very important to me, knew the political factors. But the most important thing, and those of you who've read her daily reports at the time or can look at them in IWPR, now has them on their website, and I commend you the book, it's the best way to do this. She is just a beautiful writer. And I, you know, at 11 o'clock at night, I didn't have to edit a thing. It was heaven. And it's a very, very hard task. Showing up there, going in the courtroom, it's exhausting, it's lonely. Having someone who had been in the courtroom, knew what motions were important, which were not, knew which histrionics on the part of the defense counsel to ignore, which to take seriously, and to summarize those in a compelling way is just a huge achievement. I never could have done it, and very few people could have done it. Just to give you one example, two examples of two reports that came over we'd get them and then they would go up on our website immediately and they'd come every 2 days, sometimes every day, sometimes every 3 days. One in particular, I thought, oh, it's so important to have someone in the courtroom, someone who understands the region, someone who understands the history. Was a case where an important insider witness, someone who had been in part of the command structure, had decided, the prosecution was very excited because he decided to be honest about what happened, and it was critical that he talk about the power. And Judith does a very straightforward characterization of the testimony, and then she talks about, in a very compelling way, about Milosevic's seduction of him. Basically, taking this strong man who was prepared to defy his former boss and starts reeling him in. And the description of how he suddenly starts, you know, contradicting himself and wondering what he's going to say and that sort of thing was very powerful to me, and again, a tribute to Judith and have someone in the courtroom. The other one that I remember distinctly, and I hope if you can talk about this, Judith, is when there was a farmer from Kosovo, probably illiterate, and he showed up, and Milosevic was trying to bully him and was bullying him, and he just wouldn't back down. And your description of that had people all over the world just thrilled. And I should tell you also, she had so many audiences. She had people in the United States, people in Europe, people in the region, the wonderful reporters from the region who were there covering the trial, who they worked very closely, people from other human rights groups who couldn't understandably be in the trial every day, and she would drop everything to explain things to them, explain things to members of Congress, members of the European Parliament. I mean, she was working all the time. And I recommend this book. It's terrific. It's a terrific read. You'll remember clarity that is sometimes painful, but always enlightening. So I encourage you.
Let me raise a question or two. The obvious question first, and that is, the trial lasted 4 years. Milosevic died before the trial was concluded. There was no verdict. Was it all a waste of time?
Well, my book, and I take a position that it was not. You know, that it was disappointing, very disappointing to the people who had watched it and hoped for some verdict to the prosecutors, and most of all to many of the victims. But Milosevic spent his last 5 years, 4.5, 5 years of life in a prison, you know, behind bars, which was some satisfaction, I think, for survivors and victims. The other is that the trial brought out a lot of information that otherwise wasn't known. In documents, there were, I can't even say how many documents were, I've forgotten, introduced into evidence, but it was massive. So that remains for the future. It remains for the other trials and has been drawn on, obviously, by other trials at The Hague. And ultimately, historians and people in the Balkans will have that to draw on when they're ready to do that, especially talking about Serbia too, because there are obviously people in Serbia who care very much about the truth being out and people facing that and responding how they need to respond. But it's not something that's going to happen easily or quickly. So it's there for that reason. The other piece is that it helped develop international law. You know, we went one step further. Now, I can't say that all of the decisions that were made either by the trial court or the appeals panels in the Milosevic case were ones that I found particularly legally enlightening or a step progressive, I guess. But a lot of them were, and they also discussed the issues broadly with pulling in what other tribunals and other national courts had done on those sorts of issues, like self-representation is an example. Command responsibility is another example. So just briefly, that's... I guess I'll add one other thing. It seemed really important to... Well, stepping back, just one, people will often say the victims felt this way or the survivors felt this way. Well, this is the victim? One person, and what do they look like? You know, obviously, victims and survivors have very many different opinions about, you know, the trial and everything else. And so, you know, I can't speak for them, and I would never try to. But I think that for some survivors who came to court and with great courage testified against Milosevic, that there was some satisfaction for them in confronting him. And this was, you know, the former president of their country who had absolute power, who had was the one who was responsible for destroying their families and their, you know, their businesses and their ways of life. And yet they were able to stand up to him and say, you know, Nina mentioned the farmer, and I think this is the incident she's talking about, where this elderly man had was during the Kosovo War, and his son came to him. His son's house was right in the same complex right next door to his, and he came over early in the morning, and he said, "Father, my life is ended. It's over." And he was in tears, and his father said, "What's happened?" He said, "They killed my wife and children." And he testified to this, and then he looked at Milosevic, and he said, "What is wrong with you? To kill women and children, don't you have any feelings?" And he said it with such authority and with, like, the voice of God, that there was not a pin, you know, you could have heard a pin drop in that courtroom. I don't know that anything ever necessarily affected Milosevic. He didn't respond to those sorts of things, but it certainly had an effect among the rest of people who are watching it. So.
Let me ask another question, and this one I would put to you, Nina, as well as to Judith. In the book, you talk about a number of the purposes that are served by a trial of this sort. I'm not sure you discuss this particular purpose of a trial, and let me ask whether you think a trial can serve such purposes, and whether, to any extent, the Milosevic trial did serve this purpose. The particular purpose I have in mind is that when you try a head of state for committing crimes of the sort that Milosevic committed, even though he's the head of state, and even though he has the ultimate power, he can't really commit those crimes by himself. A lot of people have to be involved in carrying out the crimes, but beyond that, he has to operate in a context that makes it possible to commit those crimes. There has to be a significant measure of public support for the crimes that are committed. And one of the purposes that could be suggested for a trial of a head of state is to help to get those who made it possible for him to carry out the crimes to reflect upon their own responsibility for those crimes, and sometimes for their active responsibility, sometimes for their passive responsibility, but nevertheless for helping to create the circumstances in which those crimes took place. I would argue that the Nuremberg prosecutions did not achieve that purpose in Germany, but that over time there were about 5,000 trials before German courts of those who committed Nazi war crimes. And in combination, I do think that process ultimately did take place. It took place over decades in Germany, but I do think it did take place. We now have trials in front of Serb courts of Serbian war criminals, in front of Croatian courts of Croatian war criminals, in front of Bosnian courts of Bosnian war criminals. The Milosevic trial by itself perhaps couldn't serve that purpose, but it helped make possible those trials that are now taking place in front of the courts of the different countries. Do you think that this question of persuading others to take responsibility or to take responsibility for their own active or passive role is a legitimate criterion by which to think about these trials, and do you think it is having that effect in the countries of the former Yugoslavia?
That's a very important point that you raise, and I do think that that's a legitimate purpose for these trials. And just a couple of the ways that I saw it play out in the Milosevic trial, one was with some of the former soldiers who volunteered to testify, and they had brought one Montenegrin soldier to testify about the war crimes that he saw he was ordered to do, and that he saw others in his unit and his superiors be involved in killing civilians. And as a result, another soldier was watching the tribunal in the trial, and he called up the prosecutor and said, "I would like to tell my story." And he did, and it was very moving. He had participated in the murder of about 12 civilians, and they were brought out from a village and stood in front of their home, and then the general gave the he wasn't a general then, but he ended up being one, gave the order to kill them all, you know. And so he shot like the others did, and one of the murdered was a little infant who, he said, cried extremely loudly, and that every night he went to sleep, he heard he heard that infant cry. And so one of the reasons that he came forward was just, you know, to try to ease his conscience a bit, you know, a little bit. So, you know, that was one case where I think that the trial was important for people, served another purpose there. The other is in just thinking about genocide, and I discuss it a little bit in the book, but because with the tribunal itself, it has now actually convicted people of genocide, but at the time that I had written the book, it had only convicted one person of aiding and abetting genocide, but nobody had been convicted of genocide. Well, you know, the moral issue there, it's a legal and a moral issue, I guess, is how many people does it take to have a genocide? And if you convict six, you know, what does that mean? What does it mean for the rest of society? So that's something that I think everyone needs to think about and contemplate, is just what is the part of people who stand by, people who follow orders. I mean, haven't we been thinking about that for 50 years, you know, 60 years since the Holocaust, and yet it's still there, that those issues are still alive.
Yeah, briefly, I don't think those domestic trials would have been pursued. I think they eventually would have been pursued, but not as early and aggressively as they have been, partly because the governments are trying to take the international pressure off. They want to say we can do this ourselves. But it's also because some of the information coming out of the international trials was actually referred to local prosecutors, and they used it in their own cases. So if the tribunal had done a consistently good job about publicity, there would have been even a greater effect. I mean, they tried and they improved it, but if for example, there had been more publicity as to the sentencing statements or I forgot the term they used, where the defendant stands up and
I'm guilty.
Yeah.
It's a plea agreement.
Plea agreement, right. And if the plea agreements early on had been publicized more, I think, you know, some brave prosecutors, this prosecutor, war crimes prosecutor in Serbia, is doing as good a job as he could possibly do given the environment there. So,
you know. Do you think it's having any effect beyond punishing, you know, those people who actually are being convicted of crimes by those courts? Is it having an effect in terms of promoting a sense of responsibility?
Excruciatingly slow in Serbia for a variety of reasons. I mean, it seems sometimes that there are, you know, there are brave people like Natasha Kandich and who understand it and understand that there needs to be a full assessment. But there is this hardcore, you know, segment of the society that still feels like victims and still feels like we were being picked on. I mean, it's stronger there than in Bosnia and Croatia. I have confidence it will, with the help of the international trials and perhaps more importantly in Serbia, the domestic trials, they will overcome this legacy. But it's still there, in my observation. Yeah, Laura, the expert.
Okay, with that, let's open it up to questions. And if you go to the microphone, Laura, do you want to?
It's a really long way in Serbia. I think it's so, and I don't think it's a hard shell. I think it's actually the society, it's the way the war was perceived, it's the way it was kind of presented by the politicians. So I think it's so far away, and I don't know that the domestic trials are having at all the desired effect at this point. And I wonder, would it have been different, because Nina, you actually touched on it, and Judith, you did. I haven't had a chance to read the book, but I look forward to reading it. Would it have been different, could it have been different if outreach had been different? Or did you really need a political consensus? Or is it also, in the way an REA often refers to this, it took a really long time in Germany. It took a long, you know, so that maybe it's just this will take an even longer, or maybe it will, you know, but is it, if the outreach, because I think that was a terrible flaw of the tribunal, would it have been different? And would you care to talk about some opportunities that may have been lost that might have given a greater effect?
Well, I think that's significant. The outreach was very important. Certainly there were efforts by journalists in the region and by Mirko Klarin and his Sense organization and that sort of thing to put information out there, but the tribunal itself failed initially. It took a long time to move up. Ultimately, would it have made a difference? I think it would have made some difference. But I think, again, with what Arye says, and I agree absolutely that it's going to take generations, and I think it would take, one or two more generations or whatever. I can't see into the future, but that's hard stuff to do. It's hard stuff for any of us to do, to take a look at something that we may have been a part of and contributed to that was so horrible. And especially, you know, one of the defense mechanisms is, I suffered too. Acknowledge that. So how do you you say yes, but you know, yes, we'll talk about that, but you have to look at this too. I think it'll take a long time, and yet I also recognize the work not just of certainly of Natasha Kandich, but of people like Women in Black, the organization Women in Black, and a lot of the other human rights groups who some of the writings that Women in Black have done when they visited with their sisters after the war in Bosnia ended, where they actually went there and sat down as Serbian women and listened to the pain and the tragedy and what happened to somebody, to somebody they cared about, is very powerful stuff. And if that also, you know, has more of a can be disseminated more broadly, I think that's important. But I don't think that it's going to happen for a while. I think maybe in another generation.
Aria, you briefly made another answer to this. I've often wondered and never taken the time to read, but if you see the difference between the way Germany and Austria have handled their past, and the way when you talk to Austrians, they don't want to acknowledge, and you talk to young Germans and they're dripping with, you know, acknowledgement. They've thought about it, they've read about it, they've studied it, and I just think it's a fascinating contrast.
Yeah. Well, I have thought that the fact of the trials before the German courts did play a crucial role. You know, during World War II, the Japanese killed about 10 million civilians, mostly in, you know, China, Korea, the Philippines, other countries of Asia. But there was never a single trial before a Japanese court after the International Military Tribunal at Tokyo. And in the Japanese case, I think what happened, and Ian Buruma has written a book actually comparing Japan and Germany on this, but I think what happened was that the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the firebombing of Tokyo, in which more than 80,000 people were killed in one night, created a sense in Japan of being the victim. And therefore, there wasn't a great sense of a need to for Japanese courts to hold Japanese war criminals accountable. Whereas in Germany, you know, I don't think there was ever quite that sense of victimization, even though there were, you know, the firebombing attacks on Dresden and Hamburg and Berlin. I don't think it ever was comparable in Germany. And there were German officials who pushed the holding of the trials before German courts. And as I say, I think that helped create a sense of responsibility. There wasn't anything like that that took place in Austria. And, you know, certainly Austrians engaged in war crimes during World War II to the same extent as Germans engaged in war crimes. So this question of how you create a sense of responsibility within a country and what role trials have in helping to create that sense of responsibility is a question that interests me greatly. I'm not sure I know the answer to the to question. Let me go to the microphone.
Yes, my name is Dr. Hello, is it on? Yes, my name is Dr. Polner. I'm president of Cinema Verite International, Inc., and I'm making a documentary on this subject now. I want to thank you for your very interesting presentation. I have a question that's somewhat related. I'd like to know in the all of the proceedings if there was any new information given on Russia's support of Milosevic. Thank you very much.
I don't think so. Nothing that came that came to the fore. Now there may have been documents that were introduced that that I didn't see, but as far as I know, there wasn't. The there were three Russian witnesses whom Milosevic had testify for him, and basically they, you know, just gave his line that it was about Kosovo, it was in the Kosovo section of the trial, and that you know, NATO was the responsible party, and Milosevic was not. So I don't really think that there was.
Did Russia seem to have empowered Milosevic? Did he feel that way?
Well, he felt that, you know, he certainly, Russia was the one that he turned to and that he relied on. And in fact, in the end, he had applied, he'd asked the court to send him to a clinic in Moscow, where his brother, who had a similar heart condition, had received treatment successfully. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you remember at the time that his wife, Mira, was there, and also his son. So they were there, and the court turned him down, saying, you know, you're getting adequate treatment here, and you're too much of a flight risk for us to send you there. Mm-hmm. And certainly the thinking was that he would have gotten there and asked for asylum. Mm-hmm. So he felt close to the Russians. I think that, you know, I don't think that they would have actually sacrificed anything for him.
Okay, thank you very much.
Those who were in power.
My question's a follow-up on Laura's in some way. Interested in the interaction between the trials and the press. And so two quick questions, I guess. One is how did the Bosnian press, like Donnie and others, cover the trial, and how did that change over those 4 years? And second, who do you happen to know who owned the managed the press in Germany, and how were the Nuremberg trials reported in Germany at the time?
Do you want to take several questions at a time, or do you want to answer these others?
I think we probably should go one by one because my memory is short. I don't know if I can answer the part of a Bosnia, how well they covered the trial and how it changed. They were there. You know, there was a reporter that they sent there who was there every day for quite a while. Emir Suljagic was there, and he certainly did a very good job of reporting what was going on. He did leave at some point before the trial was over, and I believe that somebody else that was sent from Donny, but I don't remember that the name of that reporter. So I think the information that was getting into Bosnia was pretty good. You know, in the newspaper, you know, I mean, it depends on who's reading the newspaper and that sort of thing. And I can't answer the other part.
In terms of Germany, the one thing, you know, I could say, I'm trying now to remember the name of the countess who owned the newspaper Die Zeit. She was always very intent on making clear to Germans their responsibility for the crimes that were committed by the Nazis. And the Zeit is the you know, the most prestigious newspaper in Germany. So I think probably her role was quite significant in the German context. As I say, I'm blocking on her name at the moment. Yes.
Well, I guess I have a question not just about the Milosevic trial, but the his arrest and what lessons learned that you can say that this might have for both the Karadzic trial going on in The Hague now, which they're now expecting to last at least another 2 more years, and the potential arrest of Mladic, who's also reported to be in very ill health. Would it be useful to have him arrested nonetheless and then tried and then potentially die during trial? Or do you think he should be arrested and tried nonetheless? I mean, what lessons these might have?
I'm going to turn this one to Nina, who's been working very hard for that arrest. And certainly my position is that he should be brought to justice, brought to before The Hague, or to answer whether it's going to be short-term or long-term.
Well, virtually none of these arrests happened without pressure. The Bosnians are the only entity that handed people over without pressure. At every turn, I don't believe the Karadzic arrest would have happened without outside pressure. I don't believe most of the major arrests would have happened without outside pressure. Different times, it was pressure from the United States. About half of those who were not actually arrested by forces came as a result of congressional pressure on various administrations. The other half, the more recent half, is all European Union pressure. Unfortunately, we've just had a setback on that, in that the Dutch, who were holding the line very courageously in saying nobody goes forward for EU accession, Serbia does not proceed down the road in EU accession, unless they've met the prosecutor's standard of cooperation. And they, unfortunately, in June, the EU just decided to ignore the prosecutor's somewhat ambiguous report on the level of cooperation. There's another opportunity presenting itself in the next 45 days. So if any of you are from a European country or know anyone who is in connection with an EU foreign minister, now's the time to tell them that you do not want a new member of your club who just simply are refusing to arrest a genocidaire. I mean, he is in Serbia. There's no doubt about it. They've made efforts, but they can make stronger efforts. It's inconceivable that a government with an intelligence service of its capability has not arrested him yet. So what they need to feel is outside pressure from particular And yes, he should be arrested even if he's going to die. Sorry. In jail, exactly.
Well, thank you for writing the book and look forward to reading it. I'm hoping you can comment a little bit on the work of the tribunal more broadly, because we can analyze the Milosevic trial in and of itself, but ultimately we have to consider how the tribunal pursued the leaders in Bosnia, Croatia, and as well in Kosovo. And with the latter in mind in particular, one can imagine how in Serbia the trial and the tribunal more broadly have failed to resonate as loudly as they might, because one can look at the inability to hold Kosovo Albanian leaders to account, although one of them is now back in custody, and how this may support the proposition of this being victor's justice.
I think that's been a very important issue, and it's one of the things that has been a tripwire, I think, for Serbs, especially Serb more extreme nationalists, is it just sort of the response that more Serbs have been brought before the tribunal and more Serbs have been convicted than any other ethnic group. And that's true. The answer to that is that, unfortunately, that Serbia was more the aggressor in the wars in the Balkans. And so, certainly some of the people who fought in that, the leaders of the paramilitaries and using paramilitaries the way they did, was also generated, war crimes in a larger scale. As far as Kosovo goes, I'm not sure I really can comment. They have brought others. Again, it's not an equal sum game. And what they're doing at the tribunal level is to charge individuals with the war crimes that have been committed. So it's if it's not just who started the war, but it's perpetrated the war, how you carried it out, what you did. And so those are the issues. I don't know what's going to happen with the Haradinaj retrial and that sort of thing, but I think it's an honest effort on the part of the authorities there. I'm not aware of any political stuff that is behind that. That doesn't mean that there isn't, but I'm not aware of it. Did anyone know?
I would say that at an earlier stage, I was concerned in the opposite direction. In general, I had a high regard for Louise Arbour when she was the prosecutor, but I remember having one argument with her which stretched over a period of months. And the argument was that she was initially reluctant to bring prosecutions in Kosovo because she said she couldn't identify the leaders of the Kosovan Liberation Army, the KLA, and that she felt she couldn't proceed with prosecutions related to that conflict unless she could hold them accountable in the same way that she could hold Serbs accountable. And I didn't agree with her as a matter of interpretation of international law, but it did seem to me that she was sort of bending over backwards to be even-handed in the way in which she was proceeding.
So it's on. Okay. I just want to maybe for sake of fairness, I've lived in Croatia for the last 15 years. And my perception is that no matter what verdict is given, people in Croatia are totally unsatisfied. I've never heard them say that's a good verdict. I'm generalizing, but really widespread conversations with large numbers of people. And I wonder really, we talk about failures of public relations by the tribunal, but I wonder if really it could have been, if there's any way it could have been significantly better. The perception is so strong that this is justice imposed by the big powers, and it's totally political. And the court, no matter how technically objective the court is, it's perceived on the ground, in my experience in Croatia, as biased, political, and something that we should disregard and have no appreciation for. So that I wonder if this is even a game that the court could possibly win.
Well, it may well not be. Certainly, my understanding of a lot of the Croatian response is that's the homeland war, and so you know, that colors everything. Not that you couldn't commit atrocities during a war of liberation, and many are, you know. But I think people also get confused between the justification that you're like KLA, we're justified in protecting ourselves, and same with you know in Croatia, we're fighting for our independence. Well, that doesn't mean that there weren't crimes committed during that time. But and perhaps it's at least at this point in time, it's only the Bosniaks who feel that, and of course they have their own criticisms of the tribunal, but you know some more support than you would certainly get in Croatia or Serbia.
But even the Croatian public isn't even satisfied when there are convictions of say of Serbian perpetrators. They're not satisfied with that either.
Yeah, I.
Okay. There are two more people online for the microphone, so we'll have those two questions and then wrap it up.
It's hard to decide which question to ask with an amazing resource or three amazing resources in front of us. I'm Jill Benderly, and I also have lived in the Balkans for a long time and had the opportunity to work closely with Judith a couple of times on the ground and see her at work in The Hague. So I'm very excited that the book is here. And I guess I want to come to the question as we near the close about the notion that the history of the Balkans is being written in the courtroom, which people in the region certainly believe. So if this is a long-term process of facing the realities of what's happened over the last 20 years, how do you see that? I guess the hardest struggle in a way is we've focused on the question of Serbian acknowledgement, and one of the things that's been raised often in Serbia by our colleagues and friends who oppose Milosevic's policies all those times is when that just as in Iraq, the Iraqi people were denied the opportunity to really deal with Saddam's crimes against them, that by him not being tried at first for domestic issues and never getting to the verdict, how can Serbian people ever face their own past? And what do you see as the work that needs to be done in the near term? I'm quite well acquainted with the Youth Initiative for Human Rights and others who are working using the media, using the local level. But what can we do at the sort of macro level now with the material that is available in the book and from the trial to try to move towards some speeding up this historical process, or do we just have to wait for the next generation?
Well, activists never wait. obviously, those activists in Serbia and throughout the Balkans will continue their very good efforts, and as you mentioned, the Youth Initiative is certainly one of them that's very heartening. I think that we need to support those efforts. I think that when the historians step in, and this is Balkan historians are going to have a very critical role, I think, especially if those who can see it objectively. Unfortunately, Milosevic kept bringing people, historians that had no sense of objectivity at all to the courtroom. But I am convinced that there are other historians in Serbia that do have perspective, and throughout the Balkans. And so that's a responsibility within that circle. Now, that's a pretty elite circle, but it trickles down. And I don't think that the tribunal is going to have the final say on what's history in the Balkans. It certainly is. It's influential and internationally influential, but I don't even think that it has actually established internationally what's right, what happened and what didn't happen completely. There's still a lot of disagreement over that. But I think we have to support all the efforts for people to have, support have the kind of conversations that they need to have and to have the information out there so they can develop, you know, they can examine themselves and what happened and where their place was in it and move that along.
My question concerns your discussion about the crime of genocide, and to date, genocide is only found to have occurred in Srebrenica, and as you point out, the leadership trial of Milosevic and now Karadzic concerns the criminal liability of joint criminal enterprise and also command responsibility. And there have been varying interpretations of this with regard to conviction on genocide itself versus aiding and abetting genocide. So I wonder if you could elaborate in terms of your critique, your what you've learned, your viewpoints on genocide, proof required for conviction on genocide, and the implications for the Karadzic trial.
One of the legal problems with genocide definition at The Hague is that there's a parallel definition for persecution, and they both require a specific intent. So it's you know the proof level for proving genocide is extremely high. You have to prove that there is no other possible characterization. There's no other possible characterization of what happened than the intent to commit genocide. But and with genocide, you're not looking at, for the most part, papers that said kill them all. You know, you're looking at different statements, you know, patterns of behavior, demographics, you know, all of those sorts of things to see, you know, was this genocide or not genocide. So that's the difficulty there. And you know, maybe the court has made a decision that they want, well, they have, obviously, at least at this point, that only a small number of people should be labeled genocidaires, and that, you know, it's okay, you know, we go down from there. There's aiders and abettors and complicitors and those sorts of things, but these guys up here, it doesn't kind of go along very well with the joint criminal enterprise theory where, which again, there's different ways of characterizing that, and the Milosevic trial was broadening that, the trial court was broadening that, by saying that if you join a joint criminal enterprise, you're responsible not just for what you signed on to do, but also for what's foreseeable with those partners. So if you're looking at, and Milosevic did think, you know, he thought at times, or at least he said, others said he did, that the Bosnian Serbs were really crazy and he needed to restrain them, and he was worried about what Mladic was going to do in Srebrenica in 1993 and Garaja in 94, and he pulled people back. So if that was the theory, then, you know, he has more responsibility. But it's that the definition of joint criminal enterprise and is a critical one as well. And I don't know if Jennifer wanted to say anything about that or not, but maybe not. I don't want to put you on the spot, but she's done a lot of work around the whole legal principles and out of the tribunals.
I'm really put on the spot, but just to say, my two cents are: aiding and abetting genocide is not an insignificant charge. So, you know, just that Karadzic was first, you know, tagged with that, I don't think we should dismiss it. Genocidal intent can be proved through a lot of different factors. Sometimes we do have these convenient memos, kill everyone, as we do in the chemical Ali trial, Ali Hassan al-Majid. So sometimes that exists. But you can also look at a huge variety of circumstances to deem genocidal intent to exist, so it can be inferred. So, of course, we'll never know what they could have reached, which is the frustrating thing here.
Thank you, Jennifer. And I just might say that there is there were some secret memos that we haven't seen in the Milosevic trial, the ones that were not allowed to, well, that the International Court of Justice would not request to see those memos, so it wasn't a part of their decision that Serbia was not responsible for genocide.
Okay, and Anna's at the microphone. So all right, we'll go till a quarter to two. Go ahead, Anna, quickly, and then back.
Very quickly, I just wanted to observe that the Milosevic trial had great effect on many other countries. I remember Natalia Estermirova from Chechnya mentioning the trial as a hopeful outcome for Kadyrov. And I heard also about the Milosevic trial, and Slobodan is a name they know in Eldoret in Kenya when I was discussing the... So it has some effect that you may not have considered.
That's answer quickly, and then that'll be it.
I'm looking forward to reading your book. Do you think that Izetbegovic and Tudjman would have ended in The Hague if they did not die?
I think that Tudjman would have, for sure. I mean, Carla Del Ponte said that. She said she had an indictment she was ready to issue when he died. So as far as Izetbegovic, I don't know about that. I don't have any indication that he would have.
Okay. Thank you very much. I believe that there are books for sale around the corner here. So if you haven't gotten the book, I recommend it highly. Thank you.
Thank you.